Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Insurance Law Radio. Back on February 26th, Hinshaw and our strategic alliance partner, RPC, conducted a seminar in London, England, before a packed house of leading insurance claims and underwriting professionals. We took a look at what's driving claims and exposures in the United States. And in one segment, Simon Laird, who's the head of insurance at RPC, my partner, Pedro Hernandez, and I took a look at social inflation. And we discussed what social inflation is, what are some of the underpinnings in the U.S. civil justice system driving social inflation, and some of the societal influences and trends that are really making social inflation as experienced by insurers in terms of increasing settlements and jury verdicts and defense costs, social inflation on steroids. So for this episode of Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio, we take you via tape to London, England. Stay tuned.
So a big welcome to our first RPC and Hinshaw event. For those that don't know me, my name's Simon Laird, and I head up the RPC's insurance group. And I've been leading the insurance group now for about 3 years. And one thing that was obvious to me on day one was the fact that we needed to provide our London market clients with a US solution to their challenges. US business makes up a large part of the London market's offering, and the US and London market have long had their own special relationship. So Hinshaw, who are our alliance firm in the US, are a great firm. They've got great national coverage with 21 offices across 11 states, including all the main states that carriers would want them to be. More importantly, their heritage and reputation is as a leading insurance law firm in the US, both on the coverage and defence side. Hinshaw have done a fair bit of work for the London market over the years, but what appealed to RPC when we started talking with Hinshaw about working more closely was the fact that they were willing to work together to ensure we provide a meaningful and joined up solution for the London market. This is something we in Hinshaw are committed to building and strengthening for the benefit of our clients. Any alliance between firms is of itself meaningless. It's what we do with that which will make a difference. And in that regard, today is very much the start of something. So I'm delighted to be joined on my right by the brilliant Scott Seaman.
That's why I love coming here. I don't get that in the States.
And Pedro Hernandez. So Scott is a partner in Hinshaw's head office in Chicago. He's the co-head of Hinshaw's Global Insurance Group and serves on their executive committee. Scott is regarded as one of the leading lawyers in the US and has over 30 years' experience as a commercial litigator and trial lawyer, representing insurers and reinsurers, in particular in the property and casualty matters. He's recognised by Chambers USA and has won numerous awards, including Insurance and Reinsurance Laureate of the Year in 2018, Who's Who Legal Thought Leaders in 2019, and has been recognised on the Super Lawyers list for 15 years in a row. Pedro, to my left, Pedro Hernandez, is a partner based in Hinshaw's Florida office. What I found out that is, as well as hobnobbing with the celebs, Pedro is an outstanding insurance lawyer with particular experience in construction defect and Latin American work. At the end of the session, we'll be holding a Q&A session, and we have set up Slido for you to be able to log in and put your questions up. So the hashtag that you need to search for to use Slido is hashtag US Trend Seminar. Before you put your questions up on Slido, I should point out that we are joined today by journalists. So if you want your questions to be unattributed, then you might want to put it on as anonymous. When I speak with the market on the claim side, I'm constantly reminded of the concerns in the US around bad faith exposures, and more recently about social inflation, which seems to be the buzzword for the week. Social inflation is one of a number of challenges facing the insurance market, and it's a trend that insurers need to respond to. By the end of today's session, you will hopefully have a better understanding of US exposures and the trends in that regard, and also a better understanding of how, as a market, we can respond to the challenges presented by social inflation. So I'm now going to hand over to Scott and Pedro to unpack some of these topics and provide you with some insight as to the latest development in these areas. So Scott, would you like to start us off?
Simon, and thank you for your gracious comments. You had mentioned, Simon, that social inflation, you know, you get up every day and you hear about social inflation, and it is something, it's a phrase that's trending now, but it's really something borrowed and something new, and to all the insurers, it's something blue. So you didn't know you were going to get poetry, that's a bonus. But it really combines some stuff that we've had in the U.S. for a long period of time. It's a phrase that refers to the increasing cost of insurance claims, both defense and indemnity, that results from societal trends. And it is something that affects insurers worldwide, particularly in the UK, Australia, and Canada. But the impact that you guys feel is nothing compared to the impact that it has in the US. And that's because of the so-called civil justice system or tort system in the United States, where social inflation is on steroids because of some of the things we'll talk about in a couple minutes. And insurers feel it, we sort of get a double whammy. We feel it in the first instance because when our policyholders are in that tort system, it's usually insurers that are paying a high share of defense cost and indemnity. So we're victimized in the first instance by, you know, a very plaintiff-friendly bar, certainly in the U.S. And then the second part of the whammy is the policyholder-friendly environment we find ourselves in when we're dealing with coverage litigation. So we're talking about very broad interpretations of a lot of policy provisions by courts, narrow construction of exclusions, a very broad duty to defend in the United States, and a lot of adverse consequences, some of which could be quite draconian for breaching the duty to defend. And then you pile on top of that something we'll spend a good deal of time talking about, bad faith and extra contractual liability, and you have something that keeps a lot of folks up at night. So you have these traditional factors, and let's just flip the slide and you'll see where we feel the pain, of course, is in large verdicts, and these graphs illustrate the increasing size of verdicts we've experienced in the United States over the last, since 2001, I think this goes back to one of them, and the other one focuses on 2014 and 2018. But, you know, this is something, if you went back in time and you went ever since the 1970s, you'd see a curve going like this. And this is only verdicts. So add to that the increasing size of settlements that is being fueled by the factors we're going to talk about, and of course the cost of defense, and you have the makings of something that's very costly to the industry. So just Pedro would probably say my 32-year career has been characterized by ego inflation, but it's really been characterized by social inflation, because ever since I started practicing law, we've had these dynamics in our civil justice system in the U.S. That's really been litigation out of control. And, of course, insurers and defendants and bar associations and industry groups have been fighting this and combating it with tort reform efforts, certainly going back to the 1980s. So we see the large awards. And, of course, in the U.S., the availability of punitive and exemplary damages, sometimes treble damages for many causes of action, comes into play. You have conflicting legal standards and rulings, the availability of class action and multi-district litigation, which you have that ability here, but not to the same extent that we've had historically in the U.S. And the availability of this crazy group of people known as juries. And when you try a case in front of a jury of usually 12, sometimes 6, the dynamics are very different than if you're trying a case before a judge. And the skill set for lawyers is a lot different. It starts, you know, at the beginning of the trial with voir dire and questioning prospective jurors and selecting jurors and a lot of things that you need to know that you wouldn't have to deal with if you were trying cases in front of a court, a judge. But it really impacts every phase of not only trial, but pretrial discovery, and then has an impact then once you have a jury verdict on the standard of appeal. So that's a skill set that, you know, many lawyers claim to have. A lot of plaintiffs' lawyers and policyholders' lawyers do have because they live on it, but surprisingly few insurance lawyers have that skill set. Many are focused throughout their career on motion practice and legal issues, which is important, but of course, getting in front of a jury and dealing with those dynamics are entirely different.
Hey, Scott, can I interject? One example was a few weeks ago. I was involved in a case that went to jury, and the case maybe was worth $600,000 or $700,000 at best. The jury came back $33 million on the verdict. Even the judge made a face like he was surprised by it. So that's just an example of what's going on right now in the U.S. in terms of the social inflation. I just wanted to give that example.
Yeah, and it's commonplace, and it's sometimes unnerving because no matter how well you think you've evaluated a case, and it places critical importance on evaluating cases early on, what a jury does or doesn't do oftentimes surprises the lawyers, the courts, and then you're stuck with a verdict, and what do you do? There's obviously post-verdict relief and appeal, but you do that under a little shockwave. But one of our jobs is to prevent you guys from being terribly surprised by evaluating cases, discussing the range of outcomes, and trying to spot those cases that are trouble cases early on so you can resolve them, settle them more cheaply, and without, you know, having to do it after incurring all the cost of paying lawyers, right. Which is a great thing, by the way, but, you know, it's something that many people frown upon. So that's the U.S. tort system. So you pile on that some of these more modern trends and societal influences, which we see worldwide, really. And let's talk about, first, you've got some additional things. In the U.S., certainly, very organized, well-funded plaintiffs bar. We have a system of state and federal law, so you've got 50 different jurisdictions, and then you've got the interplay. And most tort law and most insurance coverage law is a matter of state law, but that usually in coverage actions, there's arguments to be made about which state's law applies, and depending upon which jurisdiction a coverage case is pending, you will have a different rule to determine the choice of law. You know, usually in the underlying cases, the plaintiffs always get to select the forum. In coverage cases, usually the policyholder selects the forum. But there have been several notable cases in my career where being able to get out in front and filing a DJ before the policyholder has made all the difference between, you know, $500 million in exposure and no exposure or de minimis settlements. So it could be very important. And by the way, you know, most insurers I represent are very hesitant to file DJs, but there's a time and a place to do that, and you can really feel the impact when you make the decisions and you pick the right forum. We have something in the U.S. that lawyers love. It's called discovery. You know, it's not just a matter of, you know, exchanging documents. It's depositions of fact witnesses, of expert witnesses. It's all sorts of written questions, medical examinations, inspections, that go far beyond the discovery that you're used to seeing in the UK. And that means, of course, an increased cost in litigation, but it also means a hell of a burden on companies. I mean, if you get in front of the wrong judge, particularly where there are bad faith allegations, you could be incurring a lot of internal time and effort in responding to all sorts of discovery requests that you think can't possibly be related to the claim. And it also, many cases start out where the plaintiffs or the policyholders' lawyers don't really have a very good case or don't have a case of bad faith in the case of coverage litigation, and they discover their way into it through the types of facts that they gather. And the plaintiff's bar and the policyholder's bar, very organized, and they maintain libraries, folks, on different insurers. And they know what they're doing, and they keep things from case to case, notwithstanding protective orders. And so that's a phenomenon we deal with. And, of course, in America, we have the American rule on attorney's fees. So it's not loser pays here. So policyholders usually, we'll talk a minute about statutes that provide them, you know, fee-shifting statutes, where if a policyholder in many jurisdictions wins on coverage, even in part, insurance companies can be responsible for their fees, and their fees usually are considerably more substantial than the reasonable rates insurers are charged by their counsel. And of course, in the U.S., a lot of times we don't wait for the science to establish causation and medical issues. We just get a bunch of jury awards first and have a lot of junk science in our courtrooms, and then we maybe afterwards say, oh, that was too bad. These breast implants really didn't cause any injury, billions of dollars later. And then we have doctrines of res judicata and collateral estoppel, which work against corporate defendants and insurers, because if we lose one time on a policy provision or on an interpretation of an exclusion, we're going to see that forever in cases throughout the country. The policyholders just have to, their goal is maximizing coverage. They just don't have the same portfolio interest that we who represent insurers do. So that's why we've had all these major tort reform initiatives in the U.S. going back to the 1980s. And some have been more successful than others. In some states, the dangers of runaway verdicts are greater than others. So that's the U.S. background. And then you superimpose on that the trends that we have in modern society, many of which you have here in the U.K., some of which are more unique to the U.S., and you have social inflation on steroids. So one of those things is, and we're going to look at about 16 factors. I'm not known for my math, but I think that's about right. But is litigation funding? It's where you have people, companies who actually fund underlying litigation. In the old days, as bad as it was with contingency fees in the U.S., you still had at least one check, which is the plaintiff's lawyers would want to make sure that they're taking on cases where the recovery is and makes it worth their while to spend the time and incur the cost of litigation. Here, with litigation funding, they don't have the risk of coming up dry to the same extent that they did, and you've had a lot of growth. I think since 2012, the amount of litigation funding has more than doubled, and so it means more cases, more claims, and it also means larger recoveries, because when you know, an individual plaintiff is injured or claims to be injured, they don't get a recovery till the jury gives them an award and it's affirmed and they get paid or they settle. With litigation funding, they get early recovery in exchange for a cut of the action. So they have the ability to maximize recovery on cases. You don't have the same leverage working that you did in the old days when you have litigation funding. And you also have an ability for them to have better experts to go the distance and take cases to jury trial to verdict when they feel that they have a strong case. So that's been a major factor. The other thing is, I turned on the telly last night and I wasn't inundated with attorneys' ads about this claim and that claim and this substance and all the great recoveries they can get. But when I go back home and I turn on the TV after 11 o'clock at night or so, that's about all you hear. And that's why it's a tremendous recruiting tool for plaintiff's lawyers who are masters at using it. And so not only do you have more claims, but it's increased the expectations of the public in terms of, you know, recovering and having, you know, sort of their casino cash-in day with a piece of litigation. And nowadays, lawyering up. People get lawyers before they go on TV. They get lawyers before they file suit. And so in the old days, particularly where there weren't significant cases, a lot of times an individual would call the insurance company or call the company that they feel wronged them and you know, settle, which was a lot cheaper than when you get lawyers involved. And then that raises really the stakes for everybody. My whole life, I go into court and I wear a black hat. I represent insurers. Lawyers who represent companies have a very similar black hat. Not as stylish as the one my wife picks out for me, but it's a black hat. Anti-corporation, anti-insurance sentiment is something that predates the oldest person in the room, which unfortunately might be me. But it's gotten worse. It was always there, but I think, you know, after the financial crisis in the U.S., the Wall Street, what do they call it? Occupy Wall Street movement, and with social media, which is great for putting together hate groups, people who hate companies, it's really at an all-time high. As is a lack of respect and a lack of trust for our political, our social, our courtroom institutions in the U.S., and all of that just fuels more social inflation. And of course, political discourse, which is a beautiful thing. You know, we're loggerheads in the U.S., you know, conservatives and liberals, Democrats and Republicans. We see everything differently, it seems like, these days. But notions of socialism and social justice and transferring or equaling out wealth or income add to this sort of environment where you have a lot of juries more focused now on making awards based on compensating a victim regardless of fault, which is a dynamic that we have to deal with. Beliefs over fact. Now, there was a jury study that came out. 75% of these potential jury pool members who were questioned said that they would decide a case based on their own views of what is right and what is wrong, even if those views conflicted with the instructions regarding the law that the judge gives them. And that's very troubling because the legal instructions are one of the main checks we have in the jury system. And where you have that high of a percentage of jurors willing to just disregard and jury nullification, it's something that's very worrying and dangerous if you represent insurers or corporate defendants. And by the way, the number is higher among millennials. Then we have this other great concept. I mean, plaintiff's lawyers, I know there's a journalist in the room, but they're rats. And they've come up with and perfected, or at least improved, this whole notion of reptilian strategy, which is, you know, using techniques to trigger the survival instincts of jurors and get them to respond to emotional stimuli rather than facts. And that's what, you know, plaintiffs' lawyers live for. And they continue to, you know, make it into more of a science and become more effective in it. And we live in this thing called the informational age. I only half live in it because I'm a dinosaur, but even I am exposed to, you know, all the technology that we're faced with. And so you have jurors, unless you sequester them, you lock them in a hotel room and take away their TVs and take away their phones and their iPads and their whatever the hell else they have, so that they decide a case based on the evidence and not based on doing their own research. It's very unpopular. It's very rarely done that jurors are sequestered. So you have these jurors who potentially can go read what's in the press, read what's reported, and now the judge will instruct them not to do that. But we've already heard most of them will disregard that instruction. Well, specifically to this issue, 57% of the, and this is just one study, so I don't want to make too much out of it, but it is a troubling study, so they would disregard a judge's instruction and search the internet to find information if they thought doing that would be helpful. 75% would disregard instructions by the judge to ignore any evidence that they happen to hear, whether it's testimony. Sometimes in the course of a jury trial, the witness will blurt out something, there'll be an objection, it'll be sustained, and the judge will say anything. And you can imagine if it's the plaintiff or a plaintiff's expert, it could be something quite damning to the defense, and the judge will issue a corrective instruction telling the jury, disregard what you just heard or what you just saw. And jurors in three quarters will just think, if they thought the information that they heard was relevant, will disregard that instruction. So everything we're told and taught about trial practice and things to do is getting undone in many respects by modern society. We have a world of expanded liability and disappearing defenses. So, for example, in the California lead paint litigation, there was over $1 billion award that was entered. It later got reduced to about a third of that, but based on a public nuisance theory. And public nuisance was something that plaintiff's lawyers have been trying to have supported in law and in juries for many, many years, usually unsuccessful. The tide maybe could be turning a little bit. What do I mean by disappearing defenses? Well, one of the oldest, most important defenses available to a defendant is statute of limitations, that after a certain period of time, a claim is barred. And it's important because what happens, you lose evidence, your ability to access evidence, to defend yourself in a case. Well, in sexual misconduct and rape and other cases in the U.S., states across the country, not just for criminal cases, but civil cases, are abrogating those statutes of limitations. And even, for example, one of the things we had a debate the other night in the U.S. with Mayor Bloomberg from New York, and somebody had asked him, I think it was Elizabeth Warren, I know you guys don't care about the politics of it, but she asked him about all these allegations against him of sexual discrimination and hostile working environment, and would he allow the women who signed confidentiality agreements to come forward? In other words, would he waive it? And we have many states in the U.S. in the past 5 years who have started cutting back on the enforceability of confidentiality agreements, at least in the context of those cases. So a lot of those sorts of protective things are being whittled away in the U.S. Aggressive government action. You know, we are plagued by government deficits. And so we have states' attorneys general, U.S. attorney general, different department folks who are going after very aggressively, more so now than ever before, companies and insurance companies, I think, to fuel, you know, to make up gaps in the budgets. But the result of that, sometimes you can have private causes of action based on a violation of statutes or regulations. But even where you don't, the amount of additional publicity and the amount of additional evidence that gets created in that process increases liability for a lot of companies. Technology and globalization, we sort of touched on that before. So we've got all that, and then we, as insurers, when we're in coverage litigation, we deal with pro-policyholder rulings, increasing settlement costs and indemnity obligations. And so on the defense cost side, all these factors that fuel litigation, ipso facto, I'm going to use some Latin, that's the only Latin I know, increases defense costs. But then when you superimpose upon that developments on the coverage side and the increasing scope of states that allow and policyholders who pursue independent counsel, in other words, under circumstances, and it varies very much from state to state, where there are coverage issues, sometimes the policyholder is allowed to reject the insurer's panel counsel and get independent counsel, which tends to be counsel that's a lot more expensive. It also reduces the insurer's ability to receive reports, be involved in strategy, and to put reasonable controls on litigation costs. So we've got that at play. And then you look at increasing breadth and draconian consequences of the duty, of the breach of the duty to defend. So you, it's more, in a lot of states, it can be more than just you have to pay the defense cost. Sometimes you could be estopped, in other words, precluded from asserting what otherwise would be valid coverage defenses and exclusions. In other situations, you might be liable for other costs. So if a company goes bankrupt or has other expenses, or a policyholder sustains emotional distress, in some states, minority states, there can be recovery for that. So you have all that in play. And then finally, what a random universe we live in. Who gets pegged for liability and who doesn't? What actually an isolated statement or comment goes viral on the internet and what doesn't? So you never quite know what can generate liability and publicity. And a lot of times it's not sort of a course or pattern of conduct. It can be really an isolated event that goes viral. So that, ladies and gentlemen, and I have to say, there are specific jurisdictional issues at play that impact social inflation. So let's take a look at our beautiful country, the U.S. And this is a ranking of the worst states, because all states are not created equal. And there are some jurisdictions that are judicial hellholes for defendants, and some where you can get more or less a fair shake. This sort of rates the states. The next chart identifies some of these so-called judicial hellholes, or the worst jurisdictions in the U.S. Hinshaw actually has offices in every judicial hellhole. We also have offices in some places that aren't judicial hellholes. The only judicial hellhole we don't have an office in is Texas, and that's because we've been very successful in being able to represent our clients and get pro hoc into cases and get local attorneys to join us in specific jurisdictions. So finally, two more minutes, we'll skip the next slide. The following one just talks about some of the factors that go into play in evaluating the jurisdictions. So the impact of social inflation on slide 11 varies among lines of coverage, but the lines of coverage that have experienced the greatest impact are commercial auto, med-mal, professional liability, D&O, and excess and umbrella lines. So what do we do about it? First of all, my pitch to you is that you guys are all heroes, because in the insurance is what makes the free flow of goods and services, risk sharing, risk taking, and all the things that make society good go. And so insurers are maligned by plaintiffs, by policyholders, by politicians, by the media. But if you take away insurance, our economy, or if you want to treat it individually, our economies would really go to a halt, even more so than a virus could cause. But all of you guys are heroes, because we've experienced this for the 32 years that I've practiced law and beyond, and yet insurers are able to deal with these issues, survive them, thrive in environments notwithstanding all of these challenges, you know, through exercise of underwriting discipline, through looking at risk more closely, making adjustments to premium, lowering limits, adding sublimits, revising policy terms, adding exclusions, employing now AI and technology both on the claims and underwriting side, working with policyholders on loss control and safety and best practices. But mostly, it is through the talent and ingenuity of the folks that insurers hire and retain that has made the difference over the years. And that's what's going to make the difference and allow insurers to meet those challenges going forward.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.